Osiris.
Hey, this is Brendan from Umphreys McGee. This podcast is part of the Osiris podcast family. Osiris is a growing community of music and culture podcasts, connecting music fans with conversation, commentary, and of course, lots of music. Osiris works in partnership with Relics Magazine.
Bob, we have a big week coming up this week for the podcast, huh?
Yes, we do. We're going to do two episodes this week.
Do you remember how, like, 3 weeks ago, we were like, we're not going to be doing so many episodes anymore?
Yeah, we were going to quit. Ready to quit.
We're ready to quit, and now we have two episodes in a week. We're excited because, well, the conversation we had in D.C. with Glover Park Group, with Olivier Knox and Bill Plant, it was timely, so we wanted to get it out. But also, our friend Lewis Hyman, who is the author of this fantastic new book, Temp, it's coming out Tuesday, so we wanted to get the episode out for you guys the week it's coming out, so you can jump on that. You know, you don't want to be at a party and people are talking about that book and you don't know about it because we sat on the episode.
Yeah, but Temp is about the gig economy and the history of the gig economy, that we think of the gig economy as being a very 21st century phenomenon, but it's not at all. Actually, the gig economy goes back to the 1940s,
yeah,
maybe just after World War II. So it's a great book and it's very applicable to the moment we're in now. And I'm sure a lot of you out there are a part of the gig economy. We're all affected by it. No longer do you get out of college or high school and get a job with a company and that's who you work for 40 years and you retire with them and you have your benefits. It's a completely different system these days.
Yeah, and we're at Wolf Trap where the Ava Brothers are playing tonight. We're on a bus, and I got here.
But you know, we're a little backlit, but we can fix that.
I got here riding on a Lyft.
Yes.
I was in D.C., and I took the Lyft out here. It's everywhere around us, you know. As musicians, you're part of the gig economy, right?
Yeah, well, we play gigs.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it's yours, no. Right? You don't have an employer that pays you benefits, you know?
And no, yeah, that's right. You set it all up yourself. And actually, the music business has changed since the 1990s to where you don't make money on records. You make some, but very, very little. It's not like it used to be with streaming and downloads as opposed to CDs or albums. And it's completely changed for all of us. And it's, again, this Lewis's book goes a long way to explaining how we got to where we are today with it and where we might be headed in the future.
Right. And it's one of those books that's great. Lewis Hyman is a fantastic historian of capitalism at Cornell. He's good friends with Jeff Cowie. And he does a great job of putting where we are in context and also thinking what we can learn from the past and paths for the future. So I think it's going to be, you guys are going to love it. I geeked out on the episode, and it's a fantastic book. So you guys can look forward to extra episodes this week. And thank you guys for being here for us.
Wraps round me like a blanket tight, gets inside your seat and kills.
Ramzur Records is pleased to announce the release of the Ruin Brothers debut album, All My Shades of Blue, produced by Rick Rubin. Download All My Shades of Blue on June 1st. Or get your vinyl via Ramzor Records on June 22nd. Learn more by visiting ramzorrecords.com.
Lewis Hyman, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk with you guys.
Oh, and I'm excited to have you on as well. This new book you have, Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. I've been reading it, and it's got my mind in the best place. So many answers, creating so many new questions. And so what I'd like to start off asking you is, and this relates to politics as well as history, when did Americans have the good job? Because we hear about it, make America great again. What is this good job that most Americans reference, and how does it hold up historically to people's imagination of it?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, because certainly in contemporary politics, we hear a lot about this nostalgia for the post-war period when average folks had secure employment and rising wages and good bennies and all the other things that we all want, both then and now. And the truth of the matter is that for lots of people, they did get those things in the post-war period. We saw real rising wages for working class Americans at a rate that we've never seen before or after. But at the same time, lots of people were left out of that post-war world. You know, if you were a white man, you had relatively easy access to it. But for everybody else, for women, for people of color, for migrants, this is a more sort of tenuous relationship to that kind of security. And so this post-war period, which only really lasted, you know, 1945 to 1970, a very short 25 years, we've lived almost 50 years since it. And yet we still imagine that is the normal to which we should return. So this is an enduring question, I think, for labor historians to think about.
So what was it? What was it about that time period, about that moment, right? Because it's very short-lived, but it lives very large in our imagination. What were the factors that brought came together in that?
Yeah, no, it's and thank you for giving me a nice orals question as if I'm trying to get my PhD again. I appreciate that. But I think there's a lot of different factors. I mean, I think the first part you have to realize is the best reason for wages to go up is the demand for labor. So we see coming out of World War II the emergence of new industries that require millions of people, things like aerospace and electronics, as well as all other kinds of manufacturing. And this kind of investment in new industries allowed for and demanded lots of people to go to the factory. And at the same time, we have labor organizations like the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, a certain kind of industrial labor union, that managed to translate that demand into rising wages and benefits for large swaths of the American population. And this is something that defined the tone for the rest of the workforce. So the majority of Americans were never in unions, but for working Americans, the tone of the large corporations that were unionized sort of set the sort of direction for the rest of the country. And so as we think about labor, we think about corporations, we have to think about not just sort of the laws, but also the norms, the expectations of business and business leaders in this post-war period.
Something interesting to me, you talk about the industrious revolution in your book, and you say that we are in a second industrious revolution. So can you maybe explain for your listeners, because I had never heard that term before. I'm sure many of our listeners have not. What is the industrious revolution, and what makes you believe that we're in a second one right now?
So when we talk about the industrial revolution, it's very easy to evoke what we mean. We imagine steam engines, we imagine railroads, coal, etc. And what's interesting about that is those kinds of innovations happened, you know, in the first, the early 19th century. Well, before that, for about 100 years before that, we had another kind of transformation, and it was what historians call the industrious revolution. And I'm taking a little bit of liberty with that term. It starts with a historian named Jan de Vries, who used it slightly differently. But the basic idea is that before we had machines, we reorganized how we worked. So beginning in the early 18th century, British and another European people began to come into these buildings where they would just work together, these manufactories, the earliest kind of the factory. And in doing so, they didn't employ any new technology. They just worked together in a room with somebody overseeing their work. And this allowed for a tremendous uptick in productivity. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is how the technology around us, you know, it's exciting. I like my smartphone as much as the next guy. I like playing video games when I'm in the bathroom. But I think that what is really interesting to me as a historian is not these tools, is not artificial intelligence and the like. What's really interesting to me is the way work is being reorganized. So that from the earliest days of the Industrial Revolution until very recently, corporations got bigger and bigger, and corporations were the site of real productivity gains. And what we've seen in the last couple decades is the ability to work remotely, to for an individual to sell globally, to work globally, to consume globally, and without necessarily being part of a corporation. And so for me, this second industrial revolution, whether you call it the gig economy or the on-demand economy or the digital economy or the logistical economy, it's really that which is quite novel, and that which is sort of what the main thrust of the book is about. It's about how we have reorganized our work lives in the last 50 years to account for that and where that's taking us today.
Yeah, to follow up on that, you talk about how there was a time when a stable workforce was corporations courted and wanted to retain a stable workforce because they had these long-term projects, 20, 30, 40-year projects that demanded an infrastructure to make them viable and to make the company continually viable for decades to come. How did that change?
Yeah, this is one of the great exceptions of that post-war period, the idea that the corporation would last forever, that the corporation and its ongoing success mattered more than shareholders or consumers or even the workers. But somehow in the mix of that, workers and consumers and shareholders all benefited, so that all the top 100 industrial corporations made profits in this post-war period, right?
And if I could just interrupt, if I could respectfully interrupt you for a moment, I heard this the clip again recently of Mitt Romney on the 2012 campaign saying corporations are people too. Well, people don't last forever. We pass away after 60, 70 years. So if corporations are people too, well, why would they last forever?
They get old and stodgy and resistant to new ideas like old people.
I'm pretty sure that I'm going to last a good 100, 200, 300 years. I think that one of these ideas was this idea of long-term planning, the sort of deep, deep belief in progress, and that this can be a source of social benefit, that the corporation was part of one of these main institutions of America, and that it should last this long period of time. Now, very few corporations do. Mitt Romney is right. Corporations are people that die. Mitt Romney is wrong as far as corporations are people. I assure you, they are not people. But I think that this was the idea that they were in it for the long haul. And so they invested in stable workforces and long-term investment in R&D and really had their sight on the future. And so many of the technologies, this is something that's really come to light in the last few years, especially by economists like Tyler Cowen, that so many of the technologies we employ today are really refinements of those post-war technologies developed at Bell Labs and at Xerox. And we haven't had new technologies really for about since the 1960s. We've had improvements, but as we all know, that when technology gets a product gets improved, you know, workers get fewer jobs and profits go down in the long run. It's only these real breakthrough technologies like aerospace and electronics that produce lots of jobs and profits. So that's one of the things that is quite different about today than in the post-war. Our most celebrated companies, hardly anybody works at them. You know, more people work at Sears than work at Google.
Yeah, I did those numbers. Kmart still employs 45,000 people. And Uber, the promised child of the gig economy, is hitting about 12,000. You combine that with Airbnb, that's 15,000 workers. That's like one third of what Kmart still employs.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of this downsizing, a lot of this turn in corporate identity began to happen during the 1980s when a lot of restructuring took place. Maybe walk us through that great change. We talk about 1945 to 1970. Our good friend Jefferson Cowie calls that period the Great Exception. So tell us what happened in the corporate world in the 80s that made today's gig economy possible.
Yeah, so the book starts in the 1920s with the invention of the modern corporation, the modern labor movement, the modern everything, consulting and accounting and all the rest. Well, all this began to break down in the late 60s and early 70s. And it's funny, when you talk to people like my parents who were young in the 60s, and you say, well, you know, I'm really happy you listened to all that hippie music, but what really matters is the credit crunch of 1966. What really matters is the conglomerate crash of 1969. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, of course you didn't know. You were kids. You didn't know about that. And so it's important to realize that there is so much money being made in the post-war. And at the same time, these anti-monopoly laws, at the same time, this rising stock market, that the exciting wunderkinds of corporate America were these conglomerates that sort of swept everybody up and began to diversify their approaches. So in the book, I write about how less than 10% of the Fortune 500 was undiversified. And what this meant was people were taking all these profits and just buying unrelated companies. They were investing in themselves, but mostly buying unrelated companies, which we later found out produced almost no value. And so the 70s and 80s are when people begin to break up those conglomerates and they begin to think, well, how should the corporation be run? And it's in this moment that you get things where people say, well, the goal is not a forever corporation, but just the value to shareholders. So you get these new kind of ethos, not only the shareholder value movement, but also the idea that, well, maybe we should not be the biggest company in the world. Maybe we should be more efficient and small and, you know, these things and lean. And so in the book, I write a lot about how people, especially management consultants, reimagine the corporation and how it ought to be run. So I think historians spend a lot of time in anxiety around economists and how economists think. But economists are just nerds like us, squirreled away from regular folks, whereas management consultants are paid for their opinions. In the book, I talk a lot about management consultants actively reorganizing corporations along these lines and trying to make corporations more lean and more efficient. And in the process, start to peel back that job security.
I'm in the entertainment business, okay? And we've seen myself in the music business and people I know in the television business, we're in this moment where there's so much access to so much content, right?
Mm-hmm.
Netflix, they greenlight everything, waiting for the next Stranger Things, but no one's getting paid, right? The production companies aren't getting paid. The talent's not getting paid what they used to. The techs aren't getting paid. The music business, you put out a record, you don't really make money on stream. You make a very, very small fraction of what a band would have made in the 1990s on selling CDs and albums. You make very little streaming music. In fact, I've gotten checks for Spotify from Spotify. I have received checks from Spotify for 1 cent.
Oh, no.
What? So, but this is the gig economy. Right. This is the concept that someone recently filmed a whole movie on their iPhone, and it's being rumored to be possibly nominated for an Academy Award. We live in this different time. A couple schmoes like Ben and I have a podcast. We have there's no reason on earth why we should be interviewing people and putting it out there. We are not qualified to do this, but other than our own vanity. But the fact is we can do it for very low cost because of the technology. Okay? So everybody can do more. We can express ourselves any way we want to. but is anybody going to get paid?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I think what's the interesting question, you know, when people talk about the shift to the digital economy and they want to talk about manufacturing, I'm like, no. What you want to talk about is agriculture. You want to talk about the mechanical thresher. You want to talk about everybody being a farmer in the early 19th century, more or less, approximately correct, to almost nobody being a farmer today, right? Like less than.
Can I add local newspapers to that? Even more detrimental to our society than musicians getting paid for their recordings, is the fact that people don't value or pay for local news, or local reporters aren't getting paid enough to have jobs.
Yeah, it's a winner-take-all economy, right? So where just a few people get all the money, so a few YouTube stars, a few people on Spotify, a few musicians, and it's a challenge. It's a challenge to existing ways we do business and we work, and we're going to have to figure out a way to make that work. You know, I don't know if it's...
But we've been saying that since Napster, right? We've been saying that for 20 years now. Like, and with reporters, I mean, I'm glad that the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, that they're doing good again. They're doing good again because of Trump, because people care about reading what they have to write, because we live with a very rambunctious and chaotic president. People are more interested in the news because it's now reality-ified. So people care about it. So the great journalists at the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post, there's a demand, right? We want that news. Their profits are through the roof.
Mm-hmm. You might not get paid for recordings anymore. That might not be a thing that it happens in the 21st century. I mean, it might be that you only get paid for live performances, authentic experiences. And this is what people might talk be. About.
And being in the music business, that's how it becomes viable, by playing live shows, because you can't replace that.
I don't know about the music you make. I assume you're a SoundCloud rapper. And that's
that's right.
And that's right. You know, all that stuff is free, but they make their money by live shows. And so it's an advertisement for the real experience. You know, I'm not convinced that this happens in publishing. I'm a book author, but you know, next week when the book comes out, the very next day, you'll be able to get it for free on some Russian website. But you won't be able to talk to me. You won't, you know, and so that maybe it's about these feelings of moral obligation for supporting musicians and writers and creatives and filmmakers. And
well, and what about photographers, right? Now we can all take pictures with our cell phone, and we can put whatever filter we want on there, and we can doctor them up however we want them.
Yeah, it might be that photographers don't get paid unless that you want that very famous photographer from Instagram to document your wedding. You know, and then you, what did I say?
I said Cracker Farm. He's great. I don't know that he's replaceable.
And he's not replaceable, but he's being replaced.
I don't know who Cracker Farm. I don't do Instagram. But I imagine that there are famous people on it. And, you know, they'll be paid for photo shoots or this or that. But again, it's very few people as opposed to whole teams of people that would make a film in post-war America and get their Screen Actors Guild card. And part of that is the story of unions, right? It's unions that help make that possible. So how do we create new digital organizing? How do we create spaces for workers' voice to contest these kinds of relationships? That's a big question.
So one of the things I think is interesting about your work, because we're talking about kind of the macro level shifts, but you are building on something that's also been going on with like Nancy McLean. You're pointing out the way that individuals and their ideas come to shape the economy. We oftentimes think of markets in response to, you know, to crises. But as you show, there are individuals, in particular this guy, Elmer Winter, who started Manpower Incorporated, this temp company a long time ago, before we even think about temps being a big deal.
And 1947. Yes,
you open the book with the speech by him that, you know, I don't want to give away the turn on it, but he's given a speech, and it sounds like it's 2008, responding to the workforce and to the economic crisis, and it's actually a speech in 1958, is that right?
That's right. It's the first post-war recession, yeah.
And so you point out how he kind of comes in, and he's in opposition to everyone, but he works tirelessly to convince corporations that they shouldn't feel like they have any obligation to their employees. Could you talk about how he does that and his impact on the culture of corporations?
Yeah, so I write a lot about, they're not ideologues, right? They're not Friedrich Hayek. They're not like Milton Friedman. They're not people who have a certain kind of ideas out there that they just think are right or wrong. These are people who are trying to sell services. And for me, this is something, it's an important lever for how the world changes. So Elmer Winter, he founds the first big temp agency after World War II. And at first, they just offer replacement secretaries when people get sick. And then he realizes, oh, well, the big money is going to be in replacing whole sections of the workforce. You know, in 1960, he could call up Elmer Winter and or WAM Power Incorporated because he didn't answer the phones at that point. And you could replace your whole factory, the line workers, the foremen, the managers, with people from Manpower, with temps. And, you know, what's surprising, I think, and people get very frustrated when I tell them this, that it was cheaper and it was easier. It was easy. You just make a phone call. You could have it done the next day. And so this idea that what we're experiencing today is all about transaction costs or is all about the relative cost of labor. It's not just that. It's about the values of business people and business people who are trying to sell their ideas. So Elmer Winter tries to sell this idea through the 60s. It doesn't really work that well. But you also have groups like McKinsey and Company or Boston Consulting Group or Price Waterhouse, a big accountancy, all trying to sell visions of how they should be paid to change your business. And for me, this is very persuasive because corporations are paying them big bucks and they're acting on their knowledge. And so if you want to find out the ideas that are driving these changes, I think you need to look to consultants and accountants and other kinds of business advisors to understand the changes in American society.
So why were corporations reluctant to do this? Because you point this out. You say when Elmer Winter showed up, he wanted to, he said, we could do this. And corporations said, no, we don't want to do that. We want to keep people employed. We want to pay them benefits. We want to give them a, you know, help them build a retirement. You know, General Motors is pioneering this idea of giving stock to their employees. Yeah. Like you, now you're an owner. And this was going to be the reconciliation to the conflict between labor and capital. Why did corporations, which we tend to, I think now think of as short-term myopic, you know, no concern for the long-term. Why at this time were corporations so invested in becoming this workplace that provided so much for their workers when they didn't have to?
I mean, I think that's a really good question. If this is one of the values, one of the valuable lessons that history can offer as an alternative, because it's very easy to take, say, the corporation is X, capitalism is Y, and to say, well, look, the corporation changes over time, and it changes in its organization, it changes in its values, and it does this and this. Now, part of the answer to that story, of course, is the strength of the labor movement coming out of the 1930s, where they acted, to my mind, very illegally. You have the UAW forming in the middle of the Great Depression, largest corporation on the planet, General Motors, with the Flint shutdown sit-down strike, and you know, they managed to get the state to back them up. In the end of the book, I write about how what labor can learn from Uber. And I think one of the answers is, you know, act first, file the lawsuits later, you know, figure out how to act in the world. That's certainly what labor did in the 1930s. And building on that strength, they forced corporations to realize they had to make adjustments. So part of it is that. Part of it is that corporations were making so much money because of all these new technologies, all the demand for their stuff. We were, on the one hand, rebuilding Europe, and that's certainly what people talk about a lot. They talk about World War II. World War II saved the economy. World War II saved it. You know, if you talk to that drunk uncle at a barbecue, that's what he always tells you. And you're like, whatever, just give me a hamburger. But in reality, what happened was that there was just a massive amount of investment from private capital, from Citibank, we couldn't have Citibank then, and Bank of America, channeled through the government, through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation by a Texan banker named Jesse Jones, into these new industries, into suburbia and rural electrification and into aerospace. You know, it wasn't just the war. It was the way that people used the crisis of war and the Depression to channel capital into new investments. Certainly World War I did not deliver any of those benefits.
So this goes along with one of my favorite quotes from the book. You write that social disruption causes technological innovation, not usually the other way around.
Yeah. So I think one of the things to realize is that the technology, the app economy, is solving for a world in which the work, and pardon my English, already sucks, right? You know, that the alternative for driving from Uber is not a good unionized job in a post-war factory. It's not even working in an office. The alternative is, you know, maybe you get enough hours at the Starbucks. Maybe you are working, you know, trying to get a shift at the local Target. And it's that reality that the Uber is the waste product of the service economy that I think a lot of people don't get, that this is the world that Americans already work in. It's already insecure. And yet we have this language that makes it all about technology when it's really about corporate organization and sort of the death of workers' voice, as well as the sort of way in which corporations have really drifted away from this social responsibility, providing work and benefits to their employees, while at the same time still making profits.
Do you think people really want to have that one corporation they work for their entire adult life, work 40 years for the same company, get good benefits, retire, get a gold watch? Do you think people really want that? I mean, this is what you're kind of saying. You're kind of saying, or what I'm hearing is, the economy we have today, the gig economy, reflects the society that we have today, meaning the wants of the young people want gigs rather than careers, right? They want the freedom to do this for a little while and then go do something else and live in Columbus, downtown Columbus, and then maybe go move to Austin, Texas for 6 years. Then maybe go out to San Francisco. Is this the economy that we're going to see? Is this our market stabilization?
Or as Bob is saying here, is in the way that Uber is just existing with a, you know, it's a garbage job compared to other garbage jobs. So Uber is good compared to what's out there. Is just the good job from the 1950s, is it just not good, but just better because it's better than what we have now?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. It's something I write about a lot in the book, as you guys know, because you're probably setting me up for this answer because you read the book. That what I write about the book is that what's great about the post-war is the economic security. So the sense that you get paid enough to pay your rent, to feed your kids, to know where your next check is coming from. And but at the same time, those jobs were kind of terrible. If you're a line worker on an assembly line, no matter how much you're paid, it is, in the book, I call it soul-breaking work. The idea of doing the same thing day in, day out for 40 years. And that's, you know, just as true if you're working in a service job, in an office, or selling something. You know, for most people, it's terrible. It's inhumane. And so one of the things that does, I think, is exciting about this gig economy, about the second industrious revolution, is the possibility that it could be returning to older American values of autonomy and self-governance, going back to older Jeffersonian impulses that, you know, I think we still share. So the question is, how do we create some security for people while giving them the independence and flexibility of this economy?
And I think this is a central tension of your book, which is this tension in all of this between liberty and security.
That's right.
Autonomy and exchanging that in return for something tangible. And this goes, you take this back to the Jeffersonian era.
I think it's the key question, right? We traded off autonomy for security in the post-war in a big, big way. That, you know, we, as the working class Americans, you know, they just, they said, look, okay, you'll give us a paycheck and certainty and we'll take it. And in return, we won't open the book. We won't do what they did in Germany, which is co-determination in the workforce and the corporations. You know, and this makes a lot of sense. I don't want to sound like I'm bashing those people because they came out of rural depression in the 20s, everybody depression in the 30s, an incredible war. Yeah, you wanted to conform. You wanted that little house in the suburbs. I get it. But I do think in the long run, people want to be free. They want to have some measure of control. And as Americans, we need to figure out a way to make sure that people can be free. And I think part of that is about, you know, rewriting the social contract between business and labor, but also leveraging technology to do it. I think technology does play a part in this insofar as we need to accelerate the way in which machines take away our jobs, because no machine, no human, I think, should do the job that the machine can do. I think that is something that is very liberating for us, even if it's scary.
So in every economy, there are those that get left behind and those that don't have the means to be trained and educate themselves. And they're just born into a different circumstance than some who succeed. You mentioned at the outset that the economy of the 1940s and 1950s kind of left women and minorities behind. Where do you see the new economy? How do you see it possibly being more equal for both women and minorities?
Well, I think it's crucial to the book. So I think one of the things that the book does is not sort of bracket out race and gender and sexuality from this account of the transformation in the economy. And I think as we move forward, you know, one of the foundations of this post-war compact was this ideology of the male breadwinner wage, that men mattered, white men mattered, and the security of their work mattered. So as long as you were married to a white man, you were good to go. And at least for me, like, I don't think that's okay. I think that everybody counts. I think we have to figure out a way in which everybody has to count in this economy. And so just as, you know, so many of our laws were built around marriage, and now today, you know, most people are having kids out of wedlock, like something like 3/4 of all kids. You know, we can't base our social policies around that. Well, about marriage, we can't base our social policies around the employer-employee relationship either. We need to figure out a way to make the economy work for everybody as we move forward.
Yeah, because as you point out, the economy has changed. The opportunities have changed in terms of what you'll do in your life. But the system in which a person tends to rely upon an employer, one employer, for retirement benefits and for health insurance, that is, they're sticking with that. And there's really no, at least anyway, in terms of politics, a better proposal put out there for that.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people have ideas about this, especially portable benefit systems, which is just, for my mind, like, that's table stakes for, you know, getting this going forward. But I think also this is this question of education, right? So one of the things that was really amazing about the post-war economy was that it included people who weren't well-educated. They had high school educations. And today, you know, in a lot of these sort of policy circles, people talk a lot about, like, well, just send everybody to college. It's like, well, only about less than the majority of Americans have never gone to college, first stop, full stop, right? So everybody that you and your fancy friends that all went to college, not you two in particular, but all, you know, that they're like these policymakers, you know, this isn't normal. This isn't what most people have done. And not everybody is capable of doing differential equations or programming a computer or reading Beowulf. And yet I think they should still have a job and live inside. And so one of the things we need to figure out is how do we create an economy that's based around the real differences in people, in their inclinations, in their opportunities, in their life courses. You know, and I would love to live in an America where there was total equality of opportunity, but we don't live in that world. We should strive for that, but we should also try to acknowledge that there are differences and that regular people need to be included who haven't gone to college. And it's hard, I think, sometimes in some of these high-level policy conversations where everyone assumes that people have had that experience or could, or don't have other interests or constraints.
Yeah, and this frustrates me as well, because I'm someone who, I built houses. I was a carpenter to pay for college. And then after I finished both my undergraduate and master's degree, I went back to building houses. And I tell my students who are in college, you know, you see so many people, especially at Middle Tennessee State University, so many people who were there because their parents told them they have to be there. And I tell them, go learn a trade. It's not like people are going to stop living in houses. In fact, things like plumbing, things like construction, that's the kind of thing that requires the kind of nuanced vision that right now can't be easily replaced. But they look at me like I'm crazy. And you yourself point out that we have, as a country, underinvested in small businesses that provide services like plumbing and these types of services where people could really have a living.
Well, what's interesting about that, too, is like there's two parts that are interesting to me. First of all, like, and also a lot of people you worked with on construction didn't want to go to college, right? They didn't want to. It's not like, oh, I really wish I could go to college. Well, they didn't want to, or they weren't able to do it. And it doesn't mean that they shouldn't have a living. One of the interesting parts of the story in the book is I write about the history of construction in Houston, and a lot of the research I did didn't end up actually into the book. But I had this really interesting interview one day with a guy who was a union buster in the 1970s and 80s in Houston, Texas, in the construction trades. And he said, you know what? We made a mistake. And I was like, what do you mean we made a mistake? And I was like, well, he's like, well, you know, we made more money in the short term, but we also destroyed the opportunities for young people to be trained in these skilled trades. And nowadays, there are still those union training programs in parts of the country, but now people are told, well, go to community college to learn it, borrow money, go into debt to learn these trades. It used to be that you could just get paid to learn a job and feel valuable. And I think we need to figure out how to do that again, how to get people on board with job training. But again, I think the answer cannot just be more education, more education, more degrees. I think that is just a pretty privileged position to take on how to create an economy. I'm sorry your students look at you like you're crazy, but my students look at me like I'm crazy too, no matter what I say. So I'm not that sympathetic.
I mean, I tell them on the first day of class that if they don't want to be there, they should drop out. The college will probably be here if they decide they want to come back. But in the meantime, if they don't have a goal, they should go. And people are like, what? Like, I wonder how many people go home and tell their parents that. And their parents are like, how dare a professor say that? It's just, I'm trying to convey to them the truth.
I guess I would close by asking the question is, do you believe that greater freedom for members of the workforce ultimately means more instability in the employment market? If that freedom automatically comes with a market that's temporary and unstable, if you can't have complete freedom and complete stability.
I don't think so. I think it's about helping people understand how to navigate that new economy. You know, we've taught people in our schools for 100 years how to be robots, and yet we're surprised when robots come, they finally take our jobs. We've taught people how to obey, sit in orderly desks and grids, and then we tell them to be creative. You know, and this isn't about going to college, this is about elementary school, right? So I think, you know, I can imagine a world where we set up our institutions where people can succeed in them so that it's easy to find jobs. It's easy to move between jobs. It's easy to have an algorithm that instead of minimizing your hours at the Starbucks and making sure you don't get full-time benefits, instead helps you find new jobs, that instead of you searching for jobs, jobs search for you. And the computers help us do that. And so there's ways in which these technologies are important, but also new kinds of institutions and organizations. So, you know, I one of the things I always tell my students is I've never seen a market. I've never been to a market. I've never encountered a market. What I have seen are businesses, and what I have seen are, you know, governments. And I feel like we can use the state and business to create relationships between people that benefit both business and workers. And this is the deep insight about the post-war period, that there are different interests, but there are also shared interests. And that if we're going to make capitalism work for everybody, if we're going to make democracy work for everybody, we need to figure out how to reconcile those, given the constraints of the economy that we're in. And what's really amazing to me is that for 100 years, there was bloody warfare, as you guys know, between labor and capital. And then it suddenly ended for the most part. It wasn't the end of conflict, but it was the end of warfare. And I hope it takes us much less time than 100 years to figure out how to do that in the digital economy. as things really get going and in this economy, to figure out how to make capitalism work for all of us, not just for the very few, as it has for the last 50 years.
To wrap up now, Lewis, we got this one question we always ask because it is the road to now. And here you are. You are a person I know because you were around doing this when I was in grad school and went to the first history of capitalism conferences back in the day. You know, you're one of the pioneers in this field of history of capitalism. How did you end up not only becoming a historian, but then coming to this really, I think, brilliant interest?
Well, thank you. I mean, I people would disagree on how interesting it is, but I do think that, I went to graduate school, I went to college, and I was going to study science, and I was sort of disaffected with science, and I happened to take a class on the history of women in America to 1919 with Elizabeth Blackmar, and she is really the person behind all of this. So Sven Beckert is her student. So many historians of capitalism are her students. She was my inspiration. And she started to ask questions about, labor and capital. And for me, it just opened my eyes to a whole way of seeing the world. And so when I went to graduate school, I went to do labor history. I went to study with Elizabeth Cohen, who's, again, a great historian. And amazing book, right? But what I noticed was that, when I studied this stuff, there was very little about the business. There was even less about the finance, particularly in the history of consumption. And so my first book was on the history of personal debt. And I wrote that because I was like, well, how do workers pay for all this stuff? How do middle class people pay for all this stuff? And why is there no history of that? And I actually was in graduate school and I wrote a paper for Lisa McGurr. And I was like, she's like, on the historiography of consumer credit. And they were like, four books. And she looked at me and she's like, you're a terrible historian. There have got to be more books. She gave me a really bad grade. She just like, you should think about something else. And I was like, well, I'm going to write my dissertation. So that's what I wrote my dissertation. And I think there were just a lot of other young historians like Julia Ott or Bethany Morton, who I became pals with, who were really interested in how do businesses work if we really historicize them? And, I think there's just so much value to think about taking something that is natural and thinking about how it's unnatural or historical. And I think, like a lot of people, I was inspired by queer theory in approaching this. So that's how I became do the work that I do. And, I'm less invested in labels than some people. I don't want to argue about what is or is not the history of capitalism. I just want to write my books try to think about questions that shed some light on how our world came to be and maybe a little bit about where it's going.
And this is what I love, this methodological shift in looking at the world like this. I must have been the 400,000th person to look at the Singer papers. But going in there with like that lens, I'm like, oh my God, like you see all these things, the investment in Russia. And it's just like, how many people have written on Singer? And you just go in there with this new lens and it's the methodological shift is amazing.
No, it's really great. And that's what's so fun about being a historian is that you can look at these sort of tired areas and papers and just everybody's different. Everybody comes to these with different sets of questions. And, I could look at the same set of papers as you or somebody else, and we'd all have different interesting things to say about it. I think it's just a wonderful time to be a historian to talk about all these different approaches. And I'm just excited to be working on this stuff now.
Well, I have to say, Lewis Hyman gets my vote for Commerce Secretary.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I definitely will not be Commerce Secretary, but I appreciate the thought.
The book is Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. It's published by Viking, and you will be able to purchase it a couple of days after this episode comes out. So go check it out. It's a wonderful book. And Lewis Hyman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys. So much fun having this conversation.
Thanks, Lewis. We appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. The Road to Now is produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, and Linda Thamer.
If you'd like to join us on Patreon and get extra content, go to roadtonow.com and click on support at the top of our page. Keep up with us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @road_2_now. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second, and a 5-star rating and a few kind words does a lot to help us get the word out. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care.